I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Across the country, August has been a disastrous month.
And if you live in Haywood County, there is a state of emergency that's been declared. So we have Transylvania County and now Haywood County under a state of emergency.
At least 10 people are dead and 31 are still missing after torrential flooding in Middle Tennessee.
Right now, there are 12 large wildfires burning across California.
These weather events have killed dozens, displaced thousands, and destroyed millions in property. But even as we respond to these moments, it is imperative to ask, just what is disaster? Okay, listen, stick with me for a second, because I want us to challenge the unspoken assumptions at the root of how we tend to understand the very idea of disaster. Let's do it by asking some questions. What if we thought of weather events like floods, fires, and quakes, not as disasters, but as shocks? Somewhat unpredictable, these shocks focus our attention and allow us to see the real disasters, disasters that exist long before a storm gathers on the horizon. Now, this would allow us to define disaster as the deeply rooted social and structural problems that lead to unequal distribution of risk, vulnerability, and resources. It is these social problems which are truly disastrous. Okay, think of the winter storm that hit Texas earlier this year. That was a shock, and it revealed a real disaster, the state's inadequate power grid.
Texans are still reeling from the power outage crisis earlier this year.
All the suffering and the terrible experience that people have is just, it's heart-wrenching, and we never want this to happen again.
But many experts see what happened as a sign of things to come, and not just in Texas.
And if we think this way, how would it alter our ideas about preparedness, mitigation, response, recovery? If disasters are social, structural, and long-term, then we're going to need more than bottled water and batteries to prepare and rebuilding the bonds of civic trust. Knowing our neighbors, investing in reliable public transportation and modern infrastructure, well, these may be much better disaster mitigation strategies than even the very best packed go bag. For more, I'm joined now by Chauncia Willis, co-founder and CEO of the Institute for Diversity and Inclusion in Emergency Management, who has been a certified emergency manager for more than 20 years. Chauncia, welcome.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Well, good. I can't wait to dig into this. And we're going to be joined also here by Jacob Remus, a clinical associate professor at NYU, where he focuses on urban disasters, working class organizations, and migration. He's also the director of the Initiative for Critical Disaster Studies. Jacob, welcome.
Thanks very much.
So I have to say, Jacob, in the fall of 2020, I did teach a course on disaster race in American politics. I put both of you all on my syllabus. And Jacob, let me start with you. Talk a little bit about how inequities impact the things that we typically define as a disaster.
Well, inequity builds in disaster in several ways, kind of before, during, and after. So if you think about before, the questions you can ask are, why do some people live in places that are going to flood or that are likely to burn down? And we know in this country that people of color are much more likely to live in areas prone to flooding. We know that people with less money are more likely to live in places that are likely to be hit by tornadoes. And then there's questions about during the event or during the disaster, people whose houses are less likely to stand up to the hazard, to the flood, to the earthquake, to the tornado. We can, again, see how the inequities in American society and in societies around the world get built into, literally built into the structures where we live and work. And then there's access to resources after the disaster, who can pressure their representatives for more aid, who has access to more informal aid, who can go to their friends, neighbors, whose relatives are more likely to have extra guest rooms if your house gets destroyed. Obviously, We know that the people who have more money, that their friends and relatives are also more likely to have more money and therefore more likely to have space and more likely to have help to aid people. So in all of these ways, all of the inequalities and inequities in our society, and then that's replicated on a global scale also, get built into how we experience disaster.
I so appreciate the sort of walking us through that, the before, the during, and the after, right? The mitigation and the response and the recovery. So, Chauncey, I'm interested here because your background is in emergency management, and I've always kind of preferred the word emergency to disaster for exactly the reasons that I was kind of starting with. But talk to me about in that work around emergency management, what you have seen as gaps or voids.
Emergency management has typically been about doing the most for the most. And when we do the most for the most, we leave out those who are most vulnerable. Unfortunately, America, like many countries around the world, has a problem. And that problem bleeds over into emergency management, into all phases of emergency management. And we see that it becomes evident during times of disaster. And really, it's discrimination in all of its ugly forms. It's anti-poverty prejudice. It's structural racism. Our country is really built on systems. And those systems, particularly the racial hierarchy, undergirds every aspect of our society, and it influences the policies and practices that have been created to uphold that system. So emergency management, it began as civil defense. The entire foundation really has a lot of elements of assumptions about who is a priority and who is not, who can be considered an acceptable loss, and who needs to recover after a disaster.
Help me understand what doing the most for the most means. Put that down where the goats can get it for me. Help me understand what that means if you're actually like doing the work of emergency management in that moment.
In that moment, you're giving everything you have towards an equality-based approach. So what that means is if you are going into a site, and many times as an emergency manager, I've been deployed to different locations. And so we're taught to give everyone the same thing, throw as many resources at that flood or tornado or hurricane. And in the recovery process, we want to make sure that if we're providing individual assistance to those impacted groups, we give everyone the same amount. We do the same thing for everyone, whether they need it or whether or not they really don't need it and they could do without. So if you think about a flood situation where one family might have flood insurance, the other one may not, we know that essentially if they both apply, they'll get pretty much the same amount. And one family might need $4,000, one family might only need $100. But we come in and we say, we want to do the most for the most people. We want to make sure that the majority of people receive assistance. And what happens is those who are most vulnerable, those who may not be able to fill out the applications properly, those who represent lower income, historically marginalized groups, immigrants and other groups, those are considered acceptable losses. So they fall into the gap.
I got it. That makes sense to me. So if there's already a pre-existing inequality, then you have an emergency, and then you give everyone equally, which sounds fair, right? Everybody gets a sandwich. But if I started out with two sandwiches and I lost one, I may only need one more to be made whole. If I started out with only one sandwich and I lost that one, right, I might need two to be made whole. So it's helpful to see how what feels like a fair decision, give everyone the same thing, can actually reproduce an inequity. And Jacob, I want to come to you on that because consistently in living through disasters, whether it was after the levee failure in New Orleans, after Hurricane Katrina, whether it's been what we've seen in Houston, after the ice storms, so frequently during the reporting, during the emergency, you'll hear things like, This is our opportunity to rebuild in a completely different way, right? To do something that is more equitable. But so often, if you come back 5, 10, 15 years later, the inequities actually got reproduced. Why do you think that is?
I think that's a really good question, and one that I grapple with a lot, because as you say, in the immediate aftermath, there's often this conversation about doing better, being more equitable. And there's often moves to that, because in the immediate aftermath of disaster, you often see the survivors organizing and developing new types of politics and building a kind of what previous scholars have called a democracy of sufferers. But as you say, then that very rarely carries forward. And I think a lot of it is built into the idea of disaster, or built into the idea of emergency, that what you want to do, built into the idea of disaster or recovery, is that we should be going back to whatever existed before. The goal of disaster response very often is to restore the status quo ante, which is to say, whatever the conditions were that produced the disaster to begin with, let's go back to that. We want to, there was a shock. We've got to go back to what it was the day before the storm. And of course, what that means is it's great for the people who had good lives before the storm, because they get to go back to having their good life. If what you had before the storm was already a crisis of affordable housing, or a crisis of environmental racism, then going back to what existed the day before the storm isn't so great. In fact, it's just setting us up for the next disaster. And so I think built into the very idea that disasters are unusual, that they are times from which to recover, gets us to that problem that we are recovering back to whatever it was that created the disaster to begin with. You really see that in the phrase to restore order, right? This is one of the very first things that we hear about. And obviously restoring order usually is done by armed men who bring violence, which is to say the police. But even the phrase restoring order, well, the order that you're restoring benefited some people, harmed others. That's manifestly true, even if you support the order. So restoring order becomes this political decision. Well, let's go back to the system that benefited some and harmed others.
Chauncey, I want to come back to something that Jacob said earlier, where he suggested, you know, why do folks live, we need to understand the inequities built in sort of our vulnerability, our kind of residential vulnerability. But I got to say, these days, it feels like everybody lives in a floodplain, that with climate change, there are none of us that can build our, you know, houses on a hill high enough to be away from the possibility of critical weather events. Talk to me about continuing inequities within the context of climate change.
That's a great question. So we're essentially in the midst of a climate crisis, and there's an urgency of now. And the climate crisis that we are experiencing impacts us every day in several ways, whether it's increased temperatures, heat waves, more frequent and larger and more intense and more impactful hurricanes, wildfires, even pandemics. Those who are most vulnerable to risk will be most impacted by this ongoing climate crisis. And we know that eventually those who are in positions of authority now, as we've seen with the last census, may soon become a part of those who are experiencing the climate crisis and are being deemed more vulnerable. So our world today really is changing, and we're all going to be experiencing some form of disaster. Eventually, I believe we're going to start seeing global resource shortages. And with scarcity comes an added layer of vulnerability. So, you know, I think right now we have to focus on equity. Equity is the word of the day, and diversity, equity, and inclusion will allow us to effectively manage the multitude of disasters that are occurring every day, but that are coming. And we just have to be realistic about that.
So, Jacob, I want to build on that insight around an inclusive and equitable way of preparing and mitigating, and also go back to your insight around a community of sufferers. And I'm wondering that even as we may be pushing for structural change in the way that emergency management happens, are there other ways that we can begin to maybe rethink what disaster preparedness looks like in our own communities? So instead of, I mean, we're going to talk a little later in the show about actually like household preparedness, but are there ways that whole communities can prepare, like knowing our neighbors and figuring out whether or not the elderly on our block or in our building have a way out? Like, what are the things that we can start doing now that can build those more equitable approaches?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I would say that the only way we can prepare for disaster is with other people, because disaster is necessarily a social event. So my NYU colleague, Eric Kleinenberg, years ago wrote a really important book about the Chicago heat wave of 1996, where he found that not only so the people who die in heat waves, of which there are more and more each year, not only are those people who die, elderly, isolated people, but that it's not just built into the individuals, that it's built into the neighborhoods, and it's built into the lives that people have lived. And so the way that masculinity and white supremacy work in this country is that older Black men are more likely to be socially isolated and therefore at risk of death in heat waves than other similar people. And that in neighborhoods in which there is little street life, aren't many stores, the housing stock is falling apart, there's high crime, so elderly people are afraid to leave the house, or there's perception of high crime. Those are places where people are much more likely to die from heat waves than bustling neighborhoods, places where there's street life, places where there's an active civil society, where there are stores where people can go, where there's less crime and people are less afraid. And so the way we need to be preparing for the ever-increasing extreme weather events that will come with climate change is to build those communities that happily we want to live in, even if the heat wave never comes, right? We all want to live in a neighborhood that is safer, that is more bustling, that has more to do, that has closer and tighter social connections. And that's also what protects us in disasters. So you talk about building, going and checking on your elderly neighbors, and that's certainly true. But I would say it's even more than that. It's building the organizations and the communities so that people aren't isolated to begin with. So in my life, that means organizing a union. That means being part of political movements. It means talking to one's neighbors and building relationships with one's neighbors a year, 2 years, 3 years before the hurricane watch.
Chauncey, I'm wondering, as you work with policymakers, with other folks who are tasked with emergency management, if some of what we're hearing from Jacob here, this like long-term planning, which is really about community building and people power building, is there a way to infuse into policymaker training that kind of insight?
Well, sure. You know, as an emergency manager, we've been doing long-term planning for a long time, and the communal approach to preparedness has always been seen as a strength. And for those emergency managers that have the influence, their leaders, their senior officials of their jurisdiction, it is important to focus on communal preparedness and to focus on cultural competence and understand that it really does take a village to be resilient.
Chauncey Willis is co-founder and CEO of the Institute for Diversity and Inclusion in Emergency Management. And Jacob Remus is a clinical associate professor at NYU. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Now, a little confession. During the first few weeks of the COVID-19 pandemic, I binge-watched all four seasons of the National Geographic Channel's Doomsday Preppers. The show focuses on a subculture of people who spend significant time and money preparing for pretty unlikely apocalyptic scenarios.
Jerry designed his biofortress specifically to keep pathogens out. But he isn't just concerned about contaminants. He's also worried about people.
Yeah, I know. It's paranoia porn. But in the early days of quarantine, many of us felt a little paranoid. It was my Eagle Scout spouse who finally convinced me that reality TV was a poor disaster preparation strategy. So we used my quarantine-induced preparedness paranoia to work on a real plan of action for our family, friends, and neighbors in case of a serious weather event. So, do you have a go bag if you need to bug out? Do you have an essentials kit prepared? Have you thought about what you would bring and what you would leave? If not, relax, we got you. Get out your notepad and get ready to take some notes. Here to give us some advice on prepping an emergency go bag is Tricia Walkendorf, who is director of the Disaster Research Center and professor of sociology at the University of Delaware. Tricia, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me here today.
So let's start. What should everybody have in their emergency go bag or kit?
So one of the things that I like to think about with a kit or a go bag is that it has a lot of flexibility to it. Some of these things might be best be stored in a backpack or what we think of when we Google the word go bag, but other things might be strategically placed like in your car if you have one or in a desk drawer if needed. If you go to FEMA or the Red Cross or your state emergency management agency, but there's 10 general categories that I usually talk about or think about. So top on that list should be information and documentation, copies of our ID, people and pet vaccination records, financial information, insurance information, prescriptions. And then having a backup that's accessible if you forget or lose it, even if it's encrypted somewhere, is vital. Second, if you happen to be evacuating in your vehicle, do you have supplies? So that's a spare tire, names of your roadside assistant plan, a full tank of gas, jumper cables, flares, the kinds of things that we really should have in our car routinely and sometimes don't. Third, having cash on hand. If you can. So sometimes people lose their credit card or they're in an area where the power's out and they can't use their Apple Pay or their credit card. Medical supplies and hygiene items, such as first aid kits, but also those prescriptions or non-prescription medications. Some people have health or disability issues that they live with, so assistive technology equipment if they require it, diapers, a few rolls of toilet paper, some non-perishable food and water, clothing and warmth. So a blanket and pillow are good items to have, as are lightweight survival blankets. A radio for some updates and some kind of lighting like a flashlight or those bright sticks or matches. And three more. So there's items like a pad of paper and pens that can be useful, especially if your phone dies. A deck of cards to pass the time. And if you have kids, something to entertain them is really important. Having your cell phone, extra chargers, adapters, even sometimes having an old phone or a tablet in your go bag. And then the final category is to think about unique circumstances. Hand sanitizer and wipes. That's particularly so now. Having extra masks is really important. Also, other unique circumstances, like is there a baby in your home? Do you have pets in your household? There's a lot of research that suggests that people often delay evacuation because of their pets. So lots of different things that we can start thinking about to make sure our family is safe if we have to leave during a very stressful time.
First of all, that's an amazing list. I love that. But what about sort of the communication aspects, the planning aspect? What if the weather event hits or the disaster of some kind hits while, you know, kids are at school and adults are at work? You know, maybe the older, parent is home for the day. How do we make sure we have a plan in addition to the items that we need?
Yeah, so often in the disaster research community, we talk about the planning process being more important than the plan itself. That's true if you talk about a community, if you talk about a household. So having these conversations in your home, where do we have the go bag? What's in it? Have we updated it recently? What are some things that we can have offsite? You know, I mentioned that aspect about the important documentation. If you have a close family member where you can have a jump drive and you have that information scanned, that's going to be really important if you can't get back home in time. Having some of those items near the door where everybody knows they can just grab it and go is key. If there's just one member of the household who knows that, that's not going to be really useful if, as you said, grandma's at home taking care of the grandkids while someone is out.
What about neighbors? Should we be having the same conversation with, you know, our floor, you know, in our apartment building or our block in our neighborhood?
Those kind of connections that we build, again, routinely are really important. When you start thinking about somebody who's down the hall from you or down the block from you who might need extra help, being able to check on them and make sure that they're okay. But it's also knowing sometimes what other resources someone might have that might be able to help out somebody who doesn't have that. Does somebody need someone else to bring some extra things in their car if they only have one and their neighbor has two? Does someone need help going down the stairs or the elevator carrying the things that they have? One of the things that's also related to is thinking about our household and how that connects to others. There's a lot of people who will rely on others to evacuate them. Maybe you have an elderly parent who lives across town, who's living on their own, but they're not going to be able to evacuate themselves. Do you have what they need? Have you worked with them to put together some stuff that's in a closet near the front door, the back door? Trying to understand who might rely on us and how we can be helpful.
I think one of the biggest lessons I will take from this conversation is the idea that the process is as important as the plan itself, right? That it's worth having these conversations and not presuming that, we've never had a disaster before, but instead like saying that we need to think about it and talk about it and create that process doesn't have to create paranoia. It can just create preparation. Thank you so much, Tricia Wackendorf, for talking with us about this critical issue. Tricia Wackendorf is the director of the Disaster Research Center and a professor of sociology at the University of Delaware. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Teresa from Kingfisher, Oklahoma, and we have been responding to natural disasters for years. My response plan for ordinary natural disasters is to shelter in place and wait for service to be restored. I would like to say I have a go bag ready if necessary, but I haven't gotten to that yet.
Hi, this is Jeremy Larson. I live in Dallas, Texas. This past year's winter storm had me alarmed that state leadership was so ill-prepared to help its own citizens. We were literally left in the dark. Since then, we've bought bottled water, clay pots, and candles to help us keep warm in the event of power loss. It was a real eye-opener and a disappointment, period.
I really don't have a plan. I'm not sure what plans my community has for disasters, but I don't really live in an area with flooding or tornadoes or forest fires or earthquakes. The biggest problem we face are blizzards and snowstorms, in which case most people just hunker down, let the snowplows do the job. Alec Lawler, Mentor, Ohio.
This is Jane in Tigard, Oregon. I think that it's very important to have something organized in any community. I belong to an HOA neighborhood of 93 townhomes. I'm a member of CERT and need to get my skills updated. But I think the most important thing is that the June heat wave taught us a lot. There's much more to various disasters, though. For instance, I'm really surprised at how many people have no idea how to shut off the water or gas to their own homes. It's kind of scary, actually.
Want to add your voice to our program? Sign up for our Listener Response Network. Just text the word START to 70101. Again, that's START to the number 70101. As always, standard data and messaging rates may apply. You can text the word STOP anytime to opt out.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's let's take a stroll over to Broadway, where producers are doing something a little different this season, supporting and celebrating the work of Black artists. All 7 of the new plays premiering this season on Broadway were written by Black playwrights. It's a testament to the activism displayed by Black theater artists over the course of the pandemic. Earlier this month, the play Passover by Antoinette Nwandu became one of the first productions to open on Broadway since the shutdowns of 2020. After the show's first performance, audience members headed out into the street for a dance party, where Nwandu addressed the crowd from a balcony.
Y'all, I feel like Black Evita. We've been rehearsing. I've been praying. We have been working, and now we are here together to tell this story of Black joy.
This is an exciting moment for theaters in New York and across the country, but it's also a precarious one. The ongoing threat of the Delta variant means that productions just starting to open back up could once again face shutdowns in the fall. With me now to talk about Broadway's current season are Maya Phillips, critic at large for the New York Times, and Vincent Cunningham, staff writer and theater critic for the New Yorker. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yeah, it's so fun.
Maya, I want to start with you, in part because as I introduce you as the New York Times and Vincent as the New Yorker, start by telling us why Broadway matters beyond New York City.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, Broadway, I feel like it sets the tone for a lot of what happens around the country. Like, obviously, I do believe in local theaters, and I think that there's always great work to be seen in, you know, regional spaces. But Broadway is just a historic institution. You'll see, you know, places across the country pick up shows that got their start on Broadway. It's a big deal.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. There is a sort of tone setting function. But then too, I mean, in a very literal sense, people from all over the country come to New York to watch Broadway shows. So, I mean, to the extent that New York is a magnet for people all around the country, Broadway, I think, has a disproportionate amount to do with that.
Maya, you just saw Passover.
I did, yes, last week.
What was that like for you?
Oh, man, I had mixed feelings just like about the experience, because I was obviously super excited to go back. You know, it was my first Broadway show in all of these months. And yet, when I was in the lobby, I had this moment of panic that all these people are around me. And of course, they're all vaccinated, but it's like a trauma response. I was like, oh, my God, there are people everywhere. How did I do this before? But then, of course, I settled down. And then once I sat down in the seat and the show started, I was just, it was so emotional. And to hear everyone cheering, everyone was so happy to be there. So it was a little of both, but mostly the good stuff.
Right. I mean, that's part of the theater piece, right? Is that the fact that when we watch something alone or even with simply our intimates, it's not the same experience as when we watch it collectively, when we watch it in the crowd. Vincent, how was your experience with Passover?
What struck me was just the weird exchange of energy that happens when you're in the room with a lot of other people. I mean, those Broadway seats are, there's not a lot of space. You really are shoulder to shoulder with other people, and like hearing their banter and sometimes, unfortunately, hearing their cell phones or like whatever it is, the crinkle of their M&M wrapper. There's a different thing that happens when, for example, someone laughs at something that you hadn't yet found funny, and you just are negotiating, okay, what do they find in that? That part of it, that sort of triangulating against other people's emotions and responses, especially as a critic, you know, when you're trying to figure out what those responses might be. I mean, it's kind of invaluable. There are, you know, lots of other things that happened during the pandemic. Virtual theater was in some ways, in some instances, amazing, but this is a different thing for sure.
It's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of it as a non-critic. I'm always just going to enjoy or hate on any given, you know, show on my own. But the idea that, I suppose, Maya, you're reading the crowd as much as you are reading the play itself.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll also add that, you know, that's an element, especially as a Black critic. Like, I won't speak for you, Vincent, but I know for me, just that immediately kind of flooded back into my mind that I'm like, obviously the content of this play is very much about race. And, you know, I'm looking around me, and once again, I'm in this crowded theater space that I'm really happy to be in, but there are white people all around me. And I'm kind of, for lack of a better word, but like policing their interactions with the play and what they find funny, how they respond to, especially the N-word that comes up a lot. Like all those things are going through my head too.
Oh gosh, it's such an important point. So much has happened since we were last on Broadway together. Vincent, it occurs to me as Maya is speaking that not only have we been in the context of a global pandemic, but obviously also in the context of the post-murder of George Floyd. And it's been so long, not only was Mr. Floyd murdered, but his murderer found guilty. I mean, this has been a time around race in America. How was that playing out for you?
One of the things that that has brought into being is like a sort of, I don't know if it's a panic response or an empathetic response or simply, you know, some level of responsiveness from Broadway and from the theater establishment in New York to try to figure out what all of that, the sort of the uprisings last summer have meant for the stage. And so Passover was this really sort of strangely congruent because incongruent thing to come back to about these men on a block and they're buffeted by these forces not unlike the forces that eventually killed George Floyd, you know, the police, and a sort of enclosure in their own environments that, like, it was very much in some ways on the nose of that development in our lives. Because when we think about coming back to Broadway, you think about, like, I don't know, Aladdin the musical or something, right? You think about like the celebratory thing. And here we have this in some ways downbeat, meditative thing that's happening around the things that we've been thinking about for the last couple of months. So it was this particular play was, you know, very interesting to come back to because it was like a sort of minor key way back into all of this.
And Maya, indeed, all seven of the new plays being produced this season on Broadway are by Black playwrights. Would that have happened without not only the uprisings, but this June 2020 letter from a group of Black theater artists titled We See You, White American Theater?
I would love to be optimistic and say, yes, I think it would eventually happen, but I'm not sure it would. I do think that, you know, the combination of the culture, like what was happening in the cultural conversation around Black Lives Matter and the We See You, White Theater, like there was so much pressure all of a sudden being put on theaters, institutions, just like figures in power, and particularly, of course, white figures in power in a way that we haven't really seen in the theater. Well, at least I haven't. I think it's great. And I think that, you know, the fact that we're seeing these institutions shift, not just with the new plays on that are coming to Broadway, but just the fact that there are new people who are coming in. There are like diversity inclusion officers. There are changing of the guard in a lot of the big theaters. Like that's all really important. And I'm really excited to be a part of that or like be a part of this moment, especially as a Black critic.
I think, you know, last summer was a time for better and worse, right? For many establishments across our country to sort of receive the incoming, you know, about what their actions and what their omissions and their blind spots have meant to the constituencies and the communities that they serve. And so, of course, the theater was no exception. But, you know, it throughout the publishing world, throughout the academic world, everywhere there was a sort of often expressed in this epistolary way, like, here's what's been going on, and here's how this part of our society has contributed to this larger mess, this conflagration that we see. So those letters, I thought, had a big impact. And the theater community, as you know, as I'm learning as a critic and sort of understanding the byways, it's a very small community. Jeremy O'Harris's Slave Play, for example, there were lots of things that happened in that producing group to sort of bring in Black audiences and change price structures and things like this. So this was a sort of a deepening of something that's been going on for a long time.
Whether you think it has changed for all time or not, it's really cool to be part of a thing while it is happening and to be able to both contribute and think about it in the moment. But I'm wondering if you also feel optimistic that the changes will be lasting and sustained.
Oh, I'm not at all an optimist, unfortunately. Yeah. So yes, I was saying that it feels great to be in this moment, but I say that with the same asterisk that Vincent was saying, that, you know, we've seen this so many times in so many industries that like there will be these changes happen. And I hope that it won't just be like this season, that this conversation is still kind of fresh in people's minds. I hope after that, after the kind of fire of everything dies down a little bit more, that we won't go to back to a season of like all white playwrights and like all white casts and all white creative teams. Like, but it's always a possibility, unfortunately. It's just, that's how this industry is. And it's just, it's dominated by whiteness, unfortunately.
You know, we started by saying, why should, you know, Broadway matter beyond New York? But also, why should it matter beyond those who have a certain kind of disposable income? How do we get to experience, be part of Broadway, these experiences you all are having, you know, being there, you know, in that actual space, hearing the Eminem rapper, unless you have hundreds of dollars in disposable income?
Yeah, it is something that frankly haunts me, right? And theater from its origins, you know, in the ancients, it's supposed to be an expression precisely of democracy, right? If it comes along with the Greeks, we think of it in parallel with something like democracy, something like broad access, something that reflects every current in the society. And so if everybody can't come, that seems like a bit of a dark joke. But I actually think that this issue of class and access has a lot to do with what we're talking about just sort of varying the offerings that come onto the stage. In both cases, it seems to me that like our country needs to realize what actually the arts give our society. You know, the Democrats have, you know, pushing forward this infrastructure bill. And part of that has been expanding what we mean by infrastructure. It seems to me that one of the deep places of infrastructure in our country is indeed the arts. And we used to have a federal writers program, a federal theater program that helped artists make work and increase their capacity to reach audiences outside of these establishments and make their work undeniable. And that's how so many of the people that we love made it to the stage in the years after the New Deal. It seems to me that our country in some ways needs to step up and provide some insurance that perhaps these establishments can't or won't. But until that's a part of it, until, you know, these ticket prices go down, and I don't know how we ease that pressure except at the highest levels, it's gonna be a bit of a shame. I think this year is kind of a test case because I think tourism is still down, right? And so we have a little bit of an experiment. Like, can we get somebody to travel not from Iowa, but from Queens to come to the theater, you know? Can we get somebody to come from Staten Island and come to the theater? What can we do here in our own backyard, this varied city that we have? We don't even forget about seeing the country. We don't see the city in these theaters. And so, you know, that to me seems like a good place to start.
I was also specifically thinking about, you know, my experience just being like a fledgling theater critic in New York. It's just like, I was affected by the accessibility too. Of course it's a different situation. Of course I am still coming from a place of privilege, but it's also difficult for certain groups of people, even within the industry, to get access to certain shows as a freelancer or whatever. I wasn't always able to like get press access into like some of the big Broadway shows. So there are like some gaps in my knowledge that are unfortunate. That's me as an actual journalist. So just imagining all these audiences that are out there who just have no awareness of the shows being happening, or like, you know, can't get out there, or just don't have the money to get out there. You know, it's all an issue.
I feel like maybe you just planted a Hamilton shade tree. I'm not sure if that was accurate or not, but that was interesting. There. I'm gonna just let that shade tree grow and spread its branches, and we won't do anything more around that.
No comment.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Great. Good. Vincent and Maya, before we go, though, I am hoping that maybe you'll both just give me one, you know, we talked a little bit here about Passover. I don't know whether to call it Passover. But tell me a little bit about at least one other play that for you is what you're really looking forward to this season. Vincent, we can start with you.
First of all, I would say that the confusion over that name is precisely one of the tensions, I think, in the play. So you are already on the right track. And something that I'm like sort of perversely waiting for, because I just don't know what to expect, is the Michael Jackson musical. I just want to know what Lynn Nottage will do with Michael Jackson, who, if you're alive now, you've probably been thinking about for your whole life.
Ooh, I am really, really psyched for Trouble in Mind, which is like, it should be a classic. It should be part of the canon, but I think that it's been kind of forgotten. And I just think it's one of the perfect plays for this moment, like just talking about bringing Black actors and like a Black show to the stage and what that actually means. So I think that's going to be exciting and to see people experience.
Maya Phillips is a critic at large for the New York Times, and I really feel like needs to come back and have a whole conversation about freelancing. And Vincent Cunningham is a theater critic for The New Yorker and drops phrases like minor key and epistolary, just like it's no big deal. And I enjoyed this very much. Vincent, thank you for being here.
So fun. Thank you so much for having
me. Maya, thank you for being here.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks.
Okay, y'all, that's all we have for you today. Be sure to join us tomorrow. We've got a great politics show lined up. And of course, call us with your show ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.